Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 53% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI staff, management, sponsors, or volunteers. Thank you. This is Sharon Lockhart with Ebony Johnson.
Thank you so much, Sharon. And today our guests are two women who have backgrounds in education, anthropology. Kendra Frink will be joining us, the executive director of 10,000 Villages in Overland Park, to discuss fair trade and the mission of 10,000 Villages. And Elizabeth Rosen will discuss her experience in historic preservation and the roles that historic buildings play in our community. And first, we will have a bit of news. In an op-ed article published by the Kansas City Star, which has recently been removed, Laura Herrick, who has been a public school teacher for 25 years, says that women can take action to prevent rapes. She starts the article off by saying, "Men need to know that no, no means no, but women can control their own bodies to help stop creating circumstances when rapes can happen." She does say that she empathizes with women who have been raped, and women need to know that it is not their fault. But she does say women want to be treated as sexual equals when it comes to desires, the ability to have casual encounters, and the enjoyment of sex. But some women act on this freedom, then want to deny their involvement later. She goes on to say when men drink, their decision-making abilities are also limited. If a woman was too drunk to know what she was doing and should be excused for what happened, then why are men not allowed to be too drunk to make good decisions? In the end, she says the bottom line is that men need to stop acting like animals and having sex with anything that breathes and intervene when they see a situation they know is wrong. She says women take charge of your bodies and your sexuality by being sober enough to stop unwanted advances and sober enough to actually enjoy sex when you choose to have it. In a rebuttal from Justin Kendall of The Pitch, Kendall says, no, it's not her responsibility to reduce the risk by not getting drunk. Rape isn't something women should have to avoid, like sunburns and colds. I can reduce the risk of getting a cold by not touching my face so much. I can reduce the risk of getting a sunburn by putting on sunscreen. That's not the same as I can reduce the risk of getting raped if I don't get drunk. Sometimes the level of intoxication is not under a woman's control. Ever heard of date rape drugs? Serena Williams wins another Wimbledon title, making this her 22nd Grand Slam tennis championship. She is now tied with the open era record of Steffi Graf. Amidst news that Jill Stein, Green Party presidential nominee, has offered her seat to Bernie Sanders, the Stein camp released the following statement. We have repeatedly asked to meet with Senator Sanders to discuss the possibilities for collaboration to continue to build a progressive revolution in the U.S. We have said we are willing to discuss a variety of cooperative approaches, including the possibility of creating a united ticket. At no point, however, have we simply offered that we just step aside and give the presidential nomination of the Green Party to Senator Sanders without serious discussions of issues and strategies. And of course, ultimately, the nomination decision rests in the hands of the delegates to the Green Party convention, though most of them are pledged to Jill Stein. For more information on the statement, you can visit her website at jill2016.com. In what feels like unending grief between the black community and police department, many question what to make of it all. PRI reports on the work of a group of first and second generation Asian Americans. An open source letter written on Google Docs by over 100 contributors gives talking points on how to explain to immigrant relatives why they should feel invested in stopping police brutality and systemic racism against black Americans. The project began with a Facebook post and series of tweets from New York City-based ethnographer Christina Hsu after the shootings of Alton Sterling in Louisiana and Philando Castile in Minnesota. You may not have grown up around people who are black, but I have. Black people are a fundamental part of my life. They are my friends, my classmates, and teammates, my roommates, my family. Today, I am scared for them, the letter begins. I hope you can consider this. The American dream cannot exist for only your children, it continues. We are all in this together, and we cannot feel safe until all our friends, loved ones, and neighbors are safe. The American dream that we seek is a place where all Americans can live without fear of police violence. This is the future that I want, and one that I hope you want too, a portion of the letter goes on to say. And that's our news for today.
Thank you, Ebony. I have a feminist friend from Springfield staying at my house, and we heard about the KC Star article, and she chose not to come down here with me because she thought she might do something irrational, because she believes that that article set women back like 50 years, victim blaming and so on and so forth. I don't know if anybody else would like to comment on that or not.
I think I feel like the lady may have wanted to, Laura may have wanted to make a point of saying women can have some sort of control, but at the same time, I like the rebuttal from the pitch of saying, you know, it's still, I just think it's such a touchy thing to say. And, you know, it's still difficult to say that, well, hey, if you placing it on, I think specifically being drunk, you know, if you don't get drunk, then that lowers your risk of being raped. It's just, I don't know what else to say besides I think that's just a tough position to, you know, to have. But well, I don't know. Yeah, well, I guess more feedback will be given. They have removed the Kansas City Star has removed the article, so we'll see. But let me introduce our guest so we can get right into the conversation for this afternoon. Kendra Frink is the executive director of 10,000 Villages Overland Park, a nonprofit fair trade store working with artisans in over 40 countries. 10,000 Villages works to establish a sustainable market for handmade products in North America, building long-term buy-in relationships in places where skilled artisan partners lack opportunities for stable income. Product sales help pay for food, education, health care, and housing for artisans who would otherwise be unemployed or underemployed. With a bachelor's in anthropology and a master's in business administration, the Every Woman crew welcomes back Kendra Frink to discuss fair trade. Hi, Kendra.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being here with us today. So let's start off by, I gave a brief introduction of 10,000 Villages, but can you give us, just in your working experience, some background on what fair trade really is? And, you know, we hear that term a lot, especially in politics now and different phases, but what is fair trade and how is 10,000 Villages a part of that?
Sure. Well, at its heart, it's a very simple concept. The fair trade movement works to ensure that artisans and farmers all over the world are paid a fair wage for a day's work and safe working conditions. It also focuses on long-term relationships. So at 10,000 Villages, you know, we really strive to, you know, place the same level of orders from artisan groups every year so that they can plan for their future and plan on that income, because that's such an important part. And it's actually what we hear from our artisans, you know, that long-term relationship and that dependable source of income is even more important than the wage itself. That being able to plan for the future is what's so important. But the fair wage is also an important part as well, and it is a fair wage in the local contexts. So, you know, what is a fair wage in Guatemala versus India versus Kenya would all be very different. But it ensures that everyone involved in the production of an item is paid a fair wage. So one item might take, you know, just one person to make it, but we have things in the store that might take as many as 20 or 30 people just to make that one item. There are things in the store that might be like, you know, a terracotta ornament set mm-hmm. that is made by one artisan workshop that comes in a little handmade paper box, which is made by a completely different artisan workshop. So we ensure that everyone involved in that process is paid that fair wage. Mm-hmm. Another really important part of it is environmental sustainability. There's a lot of products in the store that are made out of recycled materials, newspaper, plastic wrap, different things that the artisans find in their countries to use. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of products right now that are made out of recycled saris, the garments that women wear in India mm-hmm. and Bangladesh and Nepal. They've been very popular. They're brightly colored, very vibrant, very popular. So there's those pieces that are popular too, but also, you know, even in the production of these items, mm-hmm. most of them are made by hand. So we're, you know, preserving techniques and ensuring that not a lot of resources are put into natural resources are put into creating the items, since they are made by hand as opposed to using electricity. And you also find that in a lot of these situations, electricity is not reliable. So that also means that artisans, because things are made by hand, they have the opportunity to work more than if they were having to rely on electricity and that kind of thing too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're part of a national organization. 10,000 Villages as a whole has been around for 70 years. And store in Overland Park has been open for 16 years.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful store. People, if you haven't been, I mean, it's just beautiful to be. I felt like I was in a global environment. And it's nice to know that I was supporting, you know, someone who has made something by hand, and to know that there was a fair process of making something and then getting paid a valuable payment for your work. Can you speak to why you're doing this? You personally, and why someone listening may say, well, what does fair trade really have to do with me? And, you know, times are tough and maybe I want to find the cheapest thing possible because, you know, of my own finances, and how am I affected by this?
Sure. I mean, at the heart of the fair trade movement is also this concept of conscious consumerism, thinking mm-hmm. about where your purchases come from, who made your purchases, thinking about, you know, where the person who made it, you know, were they compensated fairly? Were they able to provide for their families? Our name itself, 10,000 Villages, mm-hmm. actually comes from a quote from Gandhi. And his quote is something along the lines of, you know, he's talking about India and he's saying, have we ever thought about whether the people in these villages, you know, have enough income to sustain their livelihood? Mm-hmm. Have we thought about the people in these 10,000 villages? That's mm-hmm. kind of where the quote comes from. So it's where our name comes from. And we have very humble beginnings. We actually started the national organization back in 1946, so it is our 70th anniversary, as I said earlier, with one woman in her room. Her name was Edna Ruth Byler, and she lived in Puerto Rico. And what she saw there was that the women there were creating these beautiful hand-embroidered handkerchiefs, but they did not have a market to be able to sell them. Mm-hmm. So she thought, okay, I'm going to buy up a lot of these handkerchiefs. I'll take them back to the United States. She started selling them out of the trunk of her car. She sold them to women at her church, all over the place. So we really started with one woman who saw this problem and saw a solution. And that's still what fair trade is doing today. And, you know, me personally, you know, it is also very important to think about wages and ensure that people are being compensated fairly for what they make and are able to, you know, sustain their livelihoods. But also another big part of fair trade is the cultural integrity of those items. So a really good story was published on 10,000 Villages blog recently about metalwork in India, in Moradabad. And we work with a group there called Noah's Ark. And what had happened over the past few decades is that, you know, the price of raw materials had skyrocketed. So the trade was just really dwindling in this community. And it's what the community had really relied on for years. And you know, that skill set was there and it was trained and children were trained and they learned from the time they were young from their parents. And it was a tradition, this metalworking tradition in Moradabad. Mm-hmm. And because of those raw materials and because of the fact that market dwindled, this trade was about to be lost in mm-hmm. that community. But what fair trade does and what 10,000 Villages does is open up a whole new market in North America or Europe or Australia for people to buy these beautiful handmade things and be able to support these cultural crafts in mm-hmm. those communities. Sometimes they're cultural crafts that have been practiced in these areas for even thousands of years, depending upon what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a lot of different cultural crafts. Our glasswork from the West Bank, mud cloth from West Africa, lots of different things. You know, you'll, like you mentioned, you'll walk in and you'll see that it's like a little, it's like traveling around the world,
yes,
like a little glimpse of these countries and the yeah. cultural crafts that you would see there.
Yeah, it is.
So how
Marvita's joined us.
Hi. How does a person get started as a vendor to sell you those types of items?
Sure. Yeah, that's an excellent question. So there are a lot of artisan groups all over the world who are making beautiful things. 10,000 Villages in particular, a lot of our roots, and I mentioned earlier that we've established these really long-term relationships with these artisan groups. And a lot of them, over half of them, we've been working with for 20 years, sometimes 30 years. So we've been working for them for a really long time and trying to maintain that relationship. So we aren't taking, 10,000 Villages isn't taking on a lot of new groups, but fair trade is really growing, and that's what's so important, is as we grow the movement here in the United States, we can provide more opportunities for these different artisan groups. So we get that question, you know, quite a lot, because people will come into the store and they'll say, you know, I just came back from Guatemala and I saw this group and they're making these beautiful things. And there are great organizations out there to help different artisan groups get organized. The World Fair Trade Organization helps groups in country to kind of you know, uphold the fair trade standards, learn about them, and start implementing them in their cooperatives and workshops. And then in the United States, there's a great organization called Fair Trade Federation, which enables retailers who might be interested in selling fair trade products to find fair trade wholesalers that they can start purchasing from. And that will, you know, help grow the movement. So, yeah, it's really just about making those connections in the country with the World Fair Trade Organization. That's kind of a start for artisans in country, and then being able to market the products here.
Mm-hmm. So do you all have that kind of information in your store about how to make those connections?
We do. Somebody comes in and asks, like, I'm certainly happy to help to talk with them about that. Yeah, and I actually had the opportunity to work with an artisan group in country. I was in Ghana for a summer during my graduate program, and I worked with the Global Mamas there, and it's a cooperative that makes beads out of recycled glass. They also do some batiking and seamstressing. So I've had the ability to, and very fortunate opportunity to actually see it being implemented in country, mm-hmm. and learned a lot about the roots there and kind of what it takes in country. But as I mentioned, you know, we talked about wages in local context. Mm-hmm. Everything's different in a local context, you know, so yeah. It's hard to say, yeah. Well, it works this way in Guatemala and it works this way in Ghana, and it's hard to compare country to country. But the principles are all still the same, you know, establishing those long-term relationships, paying a fair wage, environmental sustainability. It's also about safe working conditions, mm-hmm. Ensuring, you know, if artisans are using techniques that are hazardous, that they're protected properly, ensuring no children are involved in the mm-hmm. production of the items. So that's a really important part of fair trade, too. Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of just the movement of seeing ourselves as global citizens, mm-hmm. and, you know, how we're all a part. We share this earth, you know, earth together, and what we do here matters, and what we do around the world matters as well. And so if we're helping somebody else's life, no matter where it is, it in fact touches our own, you know, no matter where we are. But the ability for us now to extend and have partnerships all over the world, I think, and, you know, in trade one from another, maybe it's a face we haven't seen, but we have something that we can, a tangible item to touch and say, gosh, some part of someone's work, you know, and I've kind of been there in a sense, mm-hmm. you know, in a context. Because, like I said, coming into the store, I did feel as if I was a part of a larger presence than just, you know, being in a retail store, so to speak.
Right. So it's, and And one thing we're also able to do is for any of the items in the store, we can actually print out a story about, nice. You know, what the item's made out of and what artisan group made it and a little bit more about that artisan group. And we also, I didn't mention this earlier, but we are actually a nonprofit, mm-hmm. and we are staffed mostly by volunteers. I'm one of only four paid staff that work at the store, so chances are anytime you come in, whoever is helping you is going to be a volunteer, and they're there because they are passionate about you know what we do, so they're certainly happy to help print stories and talk about the items. They're really a very passionate group of people.
You said you were in Overland Park. What part of Overland Park are you located in?
It's in downtown Overland Park, close to the farmers market there.
Santa Fe.
Okay. Yeah.
Sharon, did you?
Oh, I've been in the store many times, and there's so much beautiful stuff. It's beautiful, beautiful things in there. I have lots of things hanging on my wall and tablecloths, and they also have fair trade chocolate.
Oh,
and
yes,
too.
Yes, it was so good. I tasted some the last time when I was in there, and it was just delicious. I think I did the tea. Did you have tea and coffee?
Yes.
Yeah, so I did tea and some chocolate, and it was really good. And you even have instructions on, sip the tea first and then do try it with the chocolate. And I actually did experience the difference. So
Good. We started doing pairings. So a couple of the different coffee and chocolate companies we buy from have suggestions about, you know, pairing a chocolate with a specific coffee or a tea. So we started offering that every day so people can kind of test and see. So it's been really popular, people trying all the products.
So how did you get started in all of this?
Well, I have an undergrad in anthropology and then a master's in business, which is really just kind of a perfect marriage for fair trade. I got involved in the movement in college, started a student group at K-State, a fair trade student group, and then just really has been involved in the movement ever since. I've had a couple of other different jobs, but then I actually started volunteering at the store, and then the manager position opened up, and here I am today, and I truly love it. It's a really great organization to work for, and the national organization is really fantastic. We also have workshops where all the staff and managers get together, and we talk about what's going on in our stores and what's going on in the larger fair trade movement, so it's wonderful.
You mentioned you traveled to Ghana, and you were able to work with some of the local artisans there. Having been to Ghana, I'm sure you enjoyed the experience, but how were you able to travel because of your job with the company?
That was back in college. So it was before I'd started with 10,000 Villages. But they do, when they can, they try to offer opportunities to travel and visit the artisan groups. And many fair trade organizations do that. And sometimes it's just a matter of going to their website and seeing if they offer mm-hmm. opportunities to travel and visit their artisans, because many of them do. They want people to go and see, you know, exactly who they're buying from and mm-hmm. see how they're working and see how it's impacted their lives. So a lot of them are very open to that. You know, if you go to their website, you can check out whether they offer those kinds of opportunities.
Kendra, can you let people know where, if is it possible for people to still volunteer at your store, at the Overland Park store, if they're interested in
volunteering? We always have opportunities for volunteers. We have a great volunteer coordinator, Karen, and she's happy to discuss the different opportunities we have with you. We do have a very fortunate problem of we have a lot of volunteers.
Oh, really? Okay.
We have a lot of people interested, but that doesn't mean that we'll turn anyone away. We want to be able to find opportunities for everyone to be involved. And even if it's just as simple as, you know, you want to come out to dinner with us for an international dinner club or, you know, something like that. We try to make a lot of different opportunities.
Oh, nice. Oh, I didn't know you had international dinner clubs.
Yeah, we try to go to a different restaurant every month. It's very fun.
Okay, so can you give us the just contact information for your store and for people that are interested in coming and learning more?
Yeah, we are in downtown Overland Park. We're at 80th and Santa Fe Drive. The address is 7947 Santa Fe Drive. And we're basically just about two blocks west of 80th and Metcalf, if you're familiar with that area. And we're open 7 days a week.
Okay, and the website address?
The website is 10,000villages.com/Overland Park is our specific store.
Okay. Okay, fantastic. Anything else you want to share with us before we transition here. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, and just thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that that most of the staff is volunteers. So that was something new for me as well. And I do before we let you go, I do want if you can share some of the specific items that people can find in the store. You know, practical everyday items, so people can know. You know, there are additional reasons to come besides it being fair trade.
Sure. Yeah, we have a lot of beautiful jewelry, really a very large selection of jewelry, scarves. We also have soaps, different food products that we already mentioned, the chocolate, coffee, tea, some fair trade olive oil, and a lot of home decor. We have pillows and wind chimes, planters. We also carry clothing. We just started recently carrying fair trade clothing, and that's gone very well. It's been very popular. Right now, we only have women's and children's, but we do have quite a selection of fair trade clothing. And candles, candle holders, and lots of wonderful decorations. I mean, if you're decorating a room in your home, it's definitely a place to come and find unique things. And a great store for gifts.
Sounds like a great gift place.
Yeah, it is.
Wonderful for gifts. You'll find something very unique.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much again, Kendra Frink with 10,000 Villages in Overland Park. We appreciate you taking some of your Saturday to join with us on the Every Woman Crew. We will be back with Elizabeth Rosen after these messages.
Pair Excellence 3, locally yours. A beer pairing with Anton's Tap Room and Cinderblock Brewing Company. At Anton's Tap Room on July 21st at 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. This five-course dinner will feature pairings from the chef at Anton's and the head brewer of Cinderblock, specifically paired to bring out the best aspects of each course. Locally brewed and locally grown, July 21st, this beer pairing dinner is at Anton's Tap Room at 1610 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Reserve your seat today at kkfi.org/events. All proceeds benefit 90.1 FM KKFI.
In 5 minutes, I heard Lema Bowie. I said, yes, welcome to America.
The Nobel Peace Laureate was in town last month to receive the 2016 Community of Christ International Peace Award during their world conference. Hear what she had to say on the forum Monday at 6 p.m.
Injustice meets mercy, and mercy meets love. Thank you.
And we are back, and let me introduce our second guest, Elizabeth Rosen. She has over 25 years of experience in historic preservation and cultural resource management. She is the founder of Rosen Preservation, a Kansas City-based historic preservation consulting firm that has worked on more than 100 historic tax credit projects, representing over $500 million of construction activity. With a master's in historic preservation and a bachelor's in anthropology and geography, the Every Woman Crew welcomes Elizabeth Rosen to discuss the importance of historic buildings as a part of our community. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, like I said, we have two anthropologists, or if you will, in the studio today. Elizabeth, can you talk to us First, explain what is preservation and what does it mean to you and to us, and kind of take it beyond the term we haphazardly hear.
Sure. To me, historic preservation is about preserving a sense of community and a sense of place and what makes each place unique. As we get into a world that is increasingly global, where we have so much connection, you start to see places look very much alike. You go to a city in the United States and a city in Europe, and there are a lot of things. You see a lot of the same stores, and people dress a lot of the same way, and they participate in a lot of the same media, a lot of the same TV shows. But it's our history and it's our geography that come together with people that make all of our places a little bit different from each other. Yeah. And historic preservation is really about preserving those differences so that we can celebrate what's special and what's unique about each of our communities.
As far as Kansas City is concerned, how How would you rate us on preservation and yeah. how much we may value it?
I moved here from the East Coast in 1993, and I always joke I spent the first 5 years justifying to people why moving to Kansas City for a career in historic preservation from Boston was really a good career move. Kansas City has a really wonderful history. And again, what makes it special is different than what makes a city like Boston or New York or San Francisco or Chicago special. There is a unique perspective on history here. I grew up in New Jersey, where our history was really focused on the Revolutionary War. Mm. And then I went to school in Vermont, where it was focused on the War of 1812. Mm. And, you know, you come to Kansas City, and, you know, on one hand, it's focused on the border wars and the Civil Wars, which I never knew the Civil War happened in this part of the country growing up. It was something that happened in Virginia and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. But it's also about trade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really tying in with what Kendra was talking about, it was about Kansas City is about moving goods and people from one place to another. Mm. It's about bringing raw materials from the West and the Southwest, getting them to markets in Chicago and other places back East, and again about bringing finished products from back East, from the manufacturing centers, out to these developing communities in the western part of the United States. And that was its history then. And when you look at the businesses that really thrive and seek out Kansas City today, you see some of those same mm-hmm. trends. It's about location, central location. It's about access to resources and people and having a central location that you can disperse goods and ideas.
Yeah. You know, that just reminded me when she was talking about this. I hadn't thought about it, but the Pony Express right. started at 83rd and State Line,
exactly.
right by my corner, and mm-hmm. the Major's house is still standing there.
Right, and all the westward trails. You yes. know, the Independence has that wonderful National Frontier Trail Center, but it's the Oregon, Santa Fe, mm-hmm. California, Mormon trails all started from here and yeah. headed west.
Mm. And so even your store is still preserving that culture of trade and, you know, cultures coming together here in Overland Park and here in the heart of America.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're still keeping that heritage there. You know, I like that you are able to share about the history of Kansas City mm-hmm. and that there are great things to treasure about, like some of these homes. What are some of the things that you can tell us about the makeup of our neighborhoods, for example, or the regions that exist here in Kansas City?
Sure. Well, I think one thing you mentioned Overland Park. One thing to think about is the names of our neighborhoods mm. and our communities. So Overland Park, it's about overland travel. You know, the stage and the wagons traveling west. Westport was this port to the west. But when you look at our neighborhoods and you know a little bit about architecture, you can see this progression of time and how our cities developed. In Kansas City, if you want to find, you know, the really old houses, which in Kansas City, Missouri is kind of, you know, 1880s, 1890s, you're going to be up sort of northeast. Those are the older neighborhoods. And Kansas City had a huge influx of population between 1900 and 1910. The city doubled in size and was part of this industrialization that happened after the Civil War. And so you see this huge swath of neighborhoods that have houses that were built between, say, 1900 and World War I. Mm-hmm. And then as you start to travel further south and east, you can see newer generations of residential architecture.
What are some of the features of the newer generations that you could...
Well, see that sort of the transition from the Kansas City shirtwaist house, which is the two- or three-story house that has stone or brick and then clapboard or stucco up above.
It's called the shirtwaist.
It's called a shirtwaist. It was like a woman's dress from the early 1900s where she would have a shirtwaist dress and a very defined waist with a larger skirt. So that was the shirtwaist house. It's a style that's very predominant in Kansas City. And then you would move on to sort of the colonial revival houses, sort of this very traditional, kind of what you think of as American architecture. And as you move later past World War II, you get ranch houses, and you know, you're moving to a one-story house instead of a two- or three-story house.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason for that happening, that transition from two-story homes to one-story homes?
Part of it was about economics. Materials and construction technologies that became available after World War II. It was also about financing. There were these new mortgage financing programs, mm-hmm. and they wanted, they preferred a more Spartan design, architectural design. They didn't want something with a lot of trim or nooks and crannies. They wanted a very clean line, a very boxy design. And they also started with a house that was a module. If you go out to, say, Roland Park is a really good example of a neighborhood that, a community that developed right after World War II. And you have these sort of one and a half story homes. They're a little square, rectangular plan. And it was a basic unit, and it was designed to be expanded as the family grew or they became more established.
I see.
I didn't know that I'd have such a good history lesson today, but this is great. And one, I will say this, because sometimes I feel I've grown up in Kansas City and I can walk around and not really understand the connections of how everything is kind of connected. Even what you were talking about, the woman, the dress and how this has influenced the buildings and even some of the other economic factors that take part. In some cases where we see people that may be fighting to preserve a church or, you know, say, oh, please don't knock down this building, what are some guidelines that we should consider when saying this is what we want to, this is a building worth preserving or, you know, versus something that is like, oh, we just need to let this go?
Yeah, that's a really tough question because there are a lot of buildings that matter to a community. And actually, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which is our national preservation advocacy group, they started a campaign a number of years ago called This Place Matters. Mm-hmm. And for the first, 20, 30 years of historic preservation, it kind of got a bad rap as being about saving the buildings that were associated with dead white men. Mm-hmm. Over time, the movement has come to embrace properties, resources that are associated with all sorts of communities. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just wealthy people, but it's people of all socioeconomic classes and how they lived, and women as well as men, and different ethnic groups, and how their story is all part of our common American story. Mm-hmm. So they created this campaign called This Place Matters. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about Monticello or the Kansas City Museum with Corinthian Hall, which was the home of a very prominent industrialist. But it's about a neighborhood church that matters to a group of people, yeah, that has a history that is important to them. And I think it's just really an incredible campaign and created a profound shift in the way we communicate historic preservation. Mm-hmm. It may have been something that we as professionals were thinking about, but not that the general population understood. Mm-hmm. And so condition is one factor we have to consider when we decide whether or not to preserve a building. Sometimes it's just a building is too far gone. You know, we say with enough money you can save everything, but that money isn't readily available. So, mm-hmm. you know, condition is one factor, but also how does that place matter to its constituency? What mm-hmm. story does it tell?
Mm-hmm. We were recently contacted by a woman who was trying to preserve a church in the Hyde Park area. Mm-hmm. I've kind of forgotten the full story, and we tried to deliberate on how we could bring this to the community. I mean, this group of people thought it was very important. This was a very old building, very beautiful building, but I think a church close to it or another business close to it thought, well, we need to tear that down and build a parking lot. And, you know, your heart just goes out to these beautiful buildings, and how do you decide, can this building be saved? Is it structurally sound enough to invest the money into, or how does one decide that?
Well, there are definitely professionals that can help with that. An architect, specifically one who is familiar with historic buildings, will be able to shed a lot of light. A structural engineer who's used to looking at historic buildings. The way a lot of these structures were built, they don't necessarily follow contemporary building processes or codes, but that doesn't mean they're not sound and they're not able to be preserved. So definitely calling in some of those professionals would be one way to start to help figure that out.
Do you ever work with organizations like Habitat for Humanity? Because I know they're doing restorations now with some of the older homes, especially in Kansas City, where before they were just doing new builds and some maintenance of other people's homes. Do you work with those types of organizations?
We don't specifically, but I know that there are definitely members of the preservation community who do.
And can you say the name of this house? This house matters?
This place matters. This place,
and where people can find information about that?
One, I think you can find information through the Historic Kansas City website, and Historic Kansas City being our local preservation advocacy group, or at preservationnation.org.
Okay.
Okay, and they actually have a little a page that you can print off. It's just black and white, and they encourage people to, you know, take a picture of their group in front of the place that matters to them, and then post it on social media with the hashtag #ThisPlaceMatters.
Oh, okay. So they really encourage people to do a grassroots type.
Yes, it's completely about grassroots.
I see.
Yeah. How has anthropology? I mean, it's a little bit obvious, but just with your degree in anthropology and your work for 25 years with preservation, can you talk about how that has unfolded? I know you and Kendra were talking before the show about, you know, there are many places to go with a degree in anthropology and how it has blossomed to historic buildings for you. Can you share a little bit of your own story?
Sure. And I started off with a focus on archaeology and graduated. In college, I just happened to take a class also in cultural geography, which sparked my interest in sort of this intersection of place and people. So the anthropology was definitely the people side, mm-hmm. and understanding culture and how that manifests. And then the cultural geography brought in the place and the buildings as well. So after I graduated and was working for a while, I knew I needed a master's degree. And I was frustrated with archaeology because you ask a question and then you answer it with more questions. You never really have a firm answer. Right. And preservation seemed like a different direction where you're dealing more with historical resources than prehistoric, so you're getting more answers, more solid answers. And so I shifted my focus and did my advanced degree in historic preservation.
Nice.
Are there things that you've learned about Kansas City folklore, like what happened to the neighborhoods after Highway 71 came in, or, you know, the impact of certain types of things on the neighborhoods? Have you learned things like that in your studies?
Absolutely. We're always learning new things and new things about the neighborhoods. And what's wonderful is Kansas City's neighborhoods are so vast. They have so many wonderful stories. We did some work with the city over the past few years, in conjunction with construction of the new East Patrol Police Campus. And so we looked at that whole area that was impacted by that new construction, and put together the story of that neighborhood and how it evolved from being a point on the Santa Fe Trail. I mean, literally, the Santa Fe Trail went through there to becoming more settled, being a scattered farmsteads, to more speculative development and the creation of neighborhoods sort of in the late 19th century, and how those neighborhoods evolved over time.
Mm-hmm. I know that as we there's a strong emphasis and push towards renovating homes in Kansas City. And I know a lot of people, when they hear the stories about the homes, it makes it that much more personal mm-hmm. to them. Is there any way that people can go and find out about their homes?
Absolutely. And yeah, the public library has a little guide online of how to research your home. So that's one good place to start. The library is a fantastic source of information. They have all of the old city directories on microfilm, and so you can just go back, look up your the address, mm-hmm. and find out who lived there. And then you cross-reference that person, you find out what their occupation was, and look at who lived there over time. There's also a terrific resource we have, which is a series of photographs that were taken in 1940, 1939. It was a public works project, and they took pictures of all of the buildings in Kansas City, Missouri that were standing at that time, and those are also available online through it's through the public library, but if you just Google Kansas City 1940 tax photos, they were tax assessor photos, you enter, they can be a little tricky to look up, but you enter the address, they go by block. Mm-hmm. So, 39th Street, Main Street, 40th Street, Warwick, and it'll pull up the block, and you can look through and find the photos.
That is fantastic. I didn't know that.
You know, and what was the first place you said to go look at? Because I'm so fascinated. Mm-hmm. My grandmother used to live, I want to say, I can remember this, it was Agnes, it was 3146 or something like that. And I've been driving around trying to find that house, and I thought I found it once. It looks quite different now. The people have really spiffed it up. They had to cut down a big tree, and it's painted a kind of a lovely sort of, not tangerine, but you know what I mean, a kind of a peachy color and with white trim. And I think that was my grandmother's house.
Fun.
So you're telling me I might be able to find a picture of that.
Yeah, it's if you go to the Missouri Valley Room at the public library, so downtown, fifth floor, and ask them, they will help you. Or you can go online and you Google Kansas City 1940 tax assessor photographs.
All right. Fantastic. We did an interview with, gosh, Sharon, I don't remember who it was now, but we did some sort of interview, and I think it was someone with Kansas City Healthy Kids. It was something of that nature. But anyway, the lady that's over the program talked about how children felt when it was a conversation on safety, and she talked about how some of the children said one of the things that makes them feel unsafe is the abandoned buildings in their neighborhoods, and how some people were really surprised that would be, you know, one of their responses, that, you know, these abandoned buildings that I walk past on my way to school. What are some of the things that we can creatively consider when it comes to abandoned buildings in our neighborhoods, and how does that relate to, you know, preserving a neighborhood in some of those buildings, or, you know, repurposing some things? Is there something that, is that a tie-in with preservation?
Absolutely. And it's such a, I mean, it's a real issue, and one the preservation community has been very involved in, particularly in some of the legacy cities, the old Rust Belt cities, places like Detroit and Flint and Cleveland. Because you don't want these abandoned buildings causing blight or creating hazards for the community, but at the same time, there's potential there to rebuild a neighborhood as well. So the program that the city had earlier this year, where they were selling buildings for a dollar, was a great step in the right direction, a way of making these properties available to people who want to live in them again and help build up the community again. I heard a story on the radio just a couple days ago, and it was a woman from Flint, Michigan, who was talking about how the city had come in and torn down multiple homes on her block. Mm-hmm. In her neighborhood, and now it felt very gap-toothed. It didn't necessarily feel safer or better. It was just different. Mm-hmm. So tearing them down isn't a panacea, but obviously we need to take care of buildings that are physically unsafe, that are structurally unsound. But figuring out a way to make them available at a low cost to folks who are willing to invest in them, and also helping people get access to resources to refurbish them, whether it's a low-interest loan or some other types of resources, is a huge step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. That's a real issue on Reviving KC, another show here at KKFI. We talk about these things, and there aren't a lot of products, banking products, available for people who want to buy homes that are under $100,000, you know, and be able to afford to support that kind of construction. So sometimes you have to do creative financing. But at the same time, I think more banks are learning that there's a growing market for doing reconstruction. And so I think it's going to be in the house owner's favor that these products will become available, especially online banking. I think they're more available than brick-and-mortar banks. Yeah, because the thing that some people with the dollar homes didn't realize is that, okay, that home is a dollar, but if you want to really renovate that home, you're going to be putting a good $50,000.
Yeah, you get what you pay for is one on one hand, but and I think they were finding that a lot of people were looking at those homes, or were very actively looking at those homes, but to fix them up and flip them, mm-hmm. and not really necessarily to invest in the neighborhood and become occupants. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's something that the program will consider, the city will consider in the next go round, is really focusing on people who are willing to, you know, move into the neighborhood and, mm-hmm. and contribute to bringing it back.
And there were incentives for those people who wanted to own the home and not just flip it. They would get $8,500 back after staying in the home, which would be the cost that it would take to demolish the home. So there are some programs, and even Kansas City is a model city for those types of programs. So it's something, another thing that Kansas City is doing well.
Yes, mm-hmm. It absolutely is.
I have a bit of some trivia in my head. What is the oldest building in Kansas City? Do you know? I know I didn't forewarn you of this. I just thought about it, but I'm not sorry for putting you on the spot.
You know, there are a few of them. It may be the Harris Carney House over here in Westport, just behind Pride's. That's a very old home, I think, pre-Civil War. There's the Seth Ward House off of Ward Parkway.
I think I know that.
That one's, yeah. I think, 1830s or 1850 maybe also. You mentioned the Alexander Major's house is kind of in that same time period also. I know there's also a house in on Cookingham Drive near the airport that mm-hmm. was built in 1830s. Mm-hmm. And actually the city of Gladstone owns a house. It's actually open to the public as a local history museum, the Atkins mm-hmm. Johnson House. And part of it, we believe, was built in like the 1820s. It's a log house underneath the clapboard that was put on in the 1850s.
Wow. Does anyone do tours of historic...
Okay. Historic Kansas City does what they call heritage hikes.
Okay.
So if you go to their website, historickansascity.org, you find those heritage hikes, and they do all sorts of different neighborhoods and areas of the city.
Okay, fantastic. All right. Any other questions, comments for our guests today?
I just love to drive around the city, and I just drove a friend through the northeast part, and we drove past the Kansas City Museum, and there's so many beautiful old houses over there.
They're stunning.
Oh, my gosh. And all over the city. I love to drive on the east side of the city. Gosh, is it Van Brunt, or what am I thinking? Swope Parkway, maybe. There's some beautiful houses down Swope Parkway.
Yeah, down by the park. There's two huge mansions.
Yes, yes. I know what you're talking about as well. I do. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth, for being here and sharing the resources on the history of Kansas City and helping us to look at historic buildings differently and the role that they actually play. And we're all tied into the same fabric.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thanks again to Kendra Frink for being here with 10,000 Villages as well. You've been listening to the Every Woman Show on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And next week we will have... Marvita, are you doing a piece for us next week? Or
are we going to do Habitat for Humanity next week?
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
So wait, Marvita's laughing. So why don't maybe we'll see. We'll be here next week.
Whatever.
Either way, we'll be here. And thank you for everyone for tuning in and listening today to the Every Woman Show, and also online at kkfi.org. Please stay tuned for our upcoming shows with Urban Connections with Donna Wolf, and then later, Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson. Have a great weekend, everybody.
I come from women who gave up their power.